Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the April 8th, 2012 edition of Don't Let It Go Unheard, the podcast devoted to the discussion of news and politics from the perspective of Ayn Rand's philosophy, objectivism. I'm your host, Amy Peikoff, and today I am pleased to have right here with me in studio, Yaron Brook, president and executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute. We'll be talking with him about his new book, which he co-authored with the Institute's own Don Watkins, as well as some of your questions and mine. Thank you for joining us here, Yaron.
Thanks for having me on, Amy.
Yeah, I've showed him the studio setup, so we might even encourage him to have a podcast of his own at some point, not that he doesn't have enough to do already. If you are listening live and you want to call in, you can call in at 760-888-5817. Again, that's 760-888-5817. You can also put comments in the chat room. We will try to keep up with those as well. We're getting a nice group forming there in the chat room. But I also have some questions that were submitted in advance on Facebook, on Yaron Brook's Facebook page. So we're going to take a look at those as well. I had one. He says, I say start off with the fundamentals. This is Brandon. He says, I say start it off with the fundamentals, objectivist metaphysics and epistemology.
A is A, and reason is man's basic means of survival.
Okay, so
we're done, right?
Yeah, we're done. We're done with that.
Good.
Actually, we're gonna have at least one question, and there's actually kind of a set of questions that will bring in metaphysics in the form of religion. So we'll do
okay.
some of that.
Okay.
But first, I wanted you to talk about your book, and it's called Free Market Revolution: How Ayn Rand's Ideas Can End Big Government, and I understand it's coming out in September. Is that right?
Yeah, it's going to launch September 18th, although you can already pre-order it on Amazon, so I encourage you all, go to Amazon and pre-order it. Or the cover that you see there is not going to be the cover on the book. They pulled the trigger a little earlier than I would have liked. But the book is there. You can pre-order it. And the more pre-orders we get, the more likely it is to appear on bestseller lists. And of course, the more likely it is to appear on bestseller lists, the more copies will sell, and the more likely it is to appear on bestseller lists.
Exactly. So it is all a virtuous circle.
Absolutely.
And if you want to find out more about the book, there is a website, and you are maybe familiar with this website of Yaron's already. Yaron and Don Watkins set up this website. It's capitalism.aynrand.org, capitalism.aynrand.org, and they have a blog. They post little brain food stories, news stories of the day that are interesting, as well as their own responses and evaluations and analyses of the news stories, plus links to relevant resources by Ayn Rand herself that are topical. But there is a tab on that website that is about the book. So if you just click on book there, then you'll find a whole video, and I watched the video the other day, of Yaron and Don Watkins talking about the book. So I don't want to repeat too much of that here. If you wanted to, Yaron, just kind of give a basic overview of the book, and then I have one question.
Yeah, well, first, I really encourage people to go and start watching us on the blog following us, I guess is the term, right?
Right.
Following us on the blog. I think you'll find there's a lot of interesting stuff. Some of the more popular things that have been on there, like 10 must reads and different topics, and we're gonna expand beyond economics and politics into a variety of different topics of recommended readings. There'll be a lot of postings about different issues, about different topics, links to quotes from Ayn Rand, but also a lot of videos. We're doing a whole series of Yaron answers where we are taking your questions, and then we're shooting short answers to those questions. Hopefully that'll be intriguing and interesting. And I think that'll be expanding, and we'll get to a pretty wide array of different questions. And really, the followers will be determining the kind of questions we do. in terms of the book, I mean, I'm really excited about this. It's the first book that, you know, I consider mine in a substantial way. I've kind of co-authored a book with Brad Thompson on neocons, but it was really his book, and I'm like the small type co-author, small font. And then, you know, I contributed to Ilan's edited book on foreign policy. But the book is really an outgrowth of both my lectures from the last 12 years, really, on capitalism and on markets, really more than that, because really this goes back to some of the classes I taught when I taught finance and ethics at Santa Clara when I was a finance professor there. And in addition to that, a lot of reading and a lot of work that Don has done on how to communicate those ideas, on bringing out a lot of kind of nuance to it. And we worked a lot on the structure and how to build it. Now, the book is not really written for the listeners of this show. The book is really written for kind of a Tea Party audience, somebody who's fed up with big government, who knows something wrong, there's something wrong with the country, but is not sure what. They don't know what to do. They don't have an intellectual agenda. This book is supposed to really provide them with that intellectual agenda. So it goes to what I consider in this context the fundamental, and that is ethics. That is the morality of self-interest versus the morality of altruism. And to me, if we can get people to think in those terms, then you can build from there. So it's not a book about philosophy. It's not a book that's going to cover epistemology and metaphysics, although it has strong metaphysical and epistemological underpinnings and implications, but it's not explicitly so. It really is focused on the ethics, the economics, the politics, and the interaction between those. And I think that's where it's really interesting, and that's where the real strength is to show how egoism manifests itself in the marketplace in a really detailed way, and how altruism really destroys that and leads to mixed economy and ultimately destruction of the mixed economy itself. So, I think it's going to be exciting. We're kind of pulling out all the stops in terms of trying to market this book and get it out there, and hopefully a lot of people listening today will be helping us both by buying the book, recommending it to other people, putting recommendations on Amazon, linking to it on Facebook, on Twitter, and, you know, everything else that they can do. We really want this book to be a bestseller, to be on the New York Times bestseller list.
I know that many of the people who listen to this show are involved in their local tea parties, so that is one thing that they could do, is they could talk about the book to the people in their local tea parties, encourage that they read it.
Buy 10, 20 copies and hand them out. So it's a bit of an investment. I think the book is right now $15 on Amazon, so not too bad. But if you buy some copies, hand them out, encourage people to buy it, talk about it, use examples from it, invite me or Don to come and speak to your local Tea Party group. I've done a lot of that over the last few years, and and Don is available, and Don's a very good speaker. So both of us are going to hit the road starting September and really, really push this book for the 6 months post September, and really try to get sales as high as possible.
The question that I had, I think, is something that you basically already answered here, which is what this book does that has not been done in any of the existing objectivist literature. And the way that I'm hearing you is that you're saying it's the audience that it's pitched to, and then also the particular perspective on Rand's philosophy that it takes in terms of the interaction between egoism and the marketplace and politics.
I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I hate to say it's never been done in objectivism, because Ayn Rand did so much, and she did everything, and she pitched her material, her various materials, to a variety of different audiences. But I don't think there's been a book written from scratch targeted at this kind of audience that integrates kind of morality, economics, and politics in a way that this book does. So I think it is unique. I think it adds to the objectivist literature. There have been some books, so maybe some of Andy's books have done this.
Andrew Bernstein.
Andy Bernstein. There might have been other books that I'm not thinking of, but you know, you guys will have to judge whether it's a significant contribution or not.
Does it also draw upon examples that Tea Party types are particularly concerned with?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think it draws on modern examples, and it draws on, if you will, the budget crisis, the entitlement crisis, kind of the political crises that we face today. So it's very relevant to the political discussion that's going on today. It's very relevant to what is going on in Washington today and what I've heard from Tea Party people. But it also addresses kind of the fears I think people have. So things like, well, what'll happen to our food if there's no food inspectors, if there's no FDA? What'll happen to elevators if there are no elevator inspectors? Won't they all start dropping and people start being killed by them? So it kind of draws on the regulatory state as it exists today and the entitlement state as it exists today. And it ties those. It ties both the existence of regulations and the existence of entitlements. It ties both of those to altruism. Altruism is the cause of regulations. Altruism is the cause of entitlements. And, you know, again, I think that tie is important. And then the only way to undo all that is a proper conception. And the question is, what is a proper conception? But a proper conception of egoism. That is, you need a proper conception of egoism to be able to say, no, elevators are not going to start dropping and people start getting killed because, you know, that's not what profit-maximizing elevator builders will do, and that's not what a marketplace built on the profit motive allows to happen. But you have to have a proper understanding of both egoism and the profit motive. So we have a whole chapter on the profit motive and what it means. So, yeah, I know. I think this is going to add significantly and definitely make some of these ideas contemporary in terms of addressing issues that are of concern to both defenders of freedom today and its critics. So, you know, the kind of criticisms we hear of capitalism all the time.
I like the fact that it's going to come out in September, which might be enough time for people to make the proper decision in the election this fall.
Well, and there's another book coming out in October, which I don't think anybody's announced yet.
I don't think they have, so but I heard about it recently.
Be,
so you,
maybe this
you
will
do
be
it.
And that is John Allison's book on the financial crisis will be coming out in October. It's got, you know, there's a major publisher. I won't announce the publisher yet because I don't think the contract's been signed. But they're really expediting the publication. So usually it takes about 9 months to publish a book. This is going to take, closer to 6-7 months. The book is really an analysis of financial crisis, both from an insider's perspective, an economic theory perspective, and a philosophical perspective. So I think it's going to be an incredibly powerful book and an incredibly important book. And again, it'll come out just before the election. And if you add to that Leonard Peikoff's book on the DIM hypothesis, you've got three books coming out in objectivism. Not that my book or John's book are on the same level philosophically as Leonard's, but they all add up because they're all about the state of the culture, where we're heading, what needs to happen, what needs to change. I think it could be a really, really powerful fall if these books are very successful in terms of sales. I think John Allison and our book is targeted at a general public. Leonard's book is definitely targeted as a more intellectual, philosophical public. But it's going to be, I think it's going to be very powerful to have three brand new books in objectivism out at the same time.
Yeah, Leonard told me that in the introduction of his book, he's saying, this is for people who already have some knowledge of philosophy. So if you aren't interested in technical philosophy, this book isn't for you or some such. I think he was exaggerating. But his book is definitely more philosophical than the two that you guys are.
Yes, no question. I mean, they talk about epistemology. I think the first couple of chapters, maybe the first three chapters, are very philosophical because he really has to
set
the context for integration and what integration means and why it's so important and why it has this explanatory power, this immense explanatory power about the culture. So it's a hugely significant book, but it is going to be a book that's going to require some real knowledge, philosophical knowledge of objectivism. On the other hand, it's a fascinating book. If you've listened to some of his lectures, they're amazing. They cover the whole span of human history. They cover examples from literature, economics, science, philosophy. So it's a huge, broad integration. So I've only really read in final form, I think, the last three chapters. So I'm looking forward to reading the whole book. It's going to be very exciting.
Very, very good. Now, all of this is great that you have this ammunition coming forth. It's going to get people excited. It's almost a call to action, some of what you're going to be releasing this fall. Unfortunately, there's nobody good for people to vote for. It's not like you're going to change people's mind. They're going to say, oh, the ideal objectivist candidate is there. If only you would vote for him. In fact, it looks like it's going to be Romney. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I don't want to endorse candidates. I'm not allowed to. But look, the election is the election. What did anybody expect? I mean, I'm surprised that people are surprised. The state of the culture is what it is. It's not ready for an objectivist candidate. Now, I know some of you believe that if only I'd endorsed Ron Paul, he would have won. But I hate to break it to you. He wouldn't have won even if I'd endorsed him. And never in my wildest dreams would I have endorsed him. It's not ready. So the culture's not ready. Let's take Ron Paul for a second. The culture's not ready for the good stuff. So like the domestic policy, the Fed, his critique of the Fed. They're not ready for that, right? And at the same time, they're not suicidal enough to accept his foreign policy. So the culture's not ready for a good candidate. People say, oh, if only you ran, you're on. If only, I mean, we would lose in a landslide. We wouldn't even be up on the podium. I mean, Gary Johnson, who I think is better than Ron Paul, couldn't even get up on the podium, right? They wouldn't even include him in the debate. So, and if he'd been included in the debate, if he'd gotten half the airtime, right, and everybody else half the airtime, he still would have lost big time in a landslide because the country's not ready to vote for a pro-capitalist candidate. That's just the reality. Accept it, guys. Even the Tea Parties don't really get it. I mean, you go up there and you tell the Tea Parties it's time to phase out Social Security, phase out Medicare and Medicaid. I mean, I've said that in front of Tea Parties and they give you a standing ovation, but they wouldn't actually vote for it. They wouldn't actually pull the trigger on it. And that's just the Tea Parties. That's a 10% of the population, the people actually show up for Tea Party rallies. So the country's not ready. We need a lot of education. That's what these books are for. All you can hope for in a political candidate today, all you can hope for, is to buy us time. And, you know, is Romney going to buy us time? I don't know. But relative to Obama, my sense is yes, he's going to buy us time relative to Obama. Obama's going to kill time, right? He's going to accelerate the process. Romney might slow it down. Are we going to still deteriorate? Yes. There are also, think about this, there are also better people among Republicans in the House and the Senate. I think that if Romney wins, they get more prominence and they buy us time. So what we need is time, time, time. It takes a long time to educate people. It takes a long time to get these ideas across. We are challenging 2,000 plus years of ideas. We're challenging everything that Americans claim to believe in. You know, we are challenging. They believe they're altruists. They believe in a mixed economy. They believe that they are their brother's keeper. I mean, one of the lines that gets me in most trouble, even in front of Tea Party, is I say, you are not your brother's keeper. And they go, wait a minute. I thought we were. Well, they're not. So, you know, it's going to take a while. That, you know, we haven't even got to the issue of religion and how religious this country is. So this is going to take time. You know, for example, Americans would not elect an atheist to the presidency, no matter what. So we got to buy time. You got to be patient. You got to invest in what matters, which is education, education, education. You got to support the activities that matter, which are education, education, education. You got to focus on the long term. And you got to focus on your own understanding of objectivism and on your own life. Politics, we're not going to have a huge impact short term on the politics. That's just a reality. Let's hope. Let's really hope we have impact on the long term on politics. Because if we don't have impact on the long term, I mean long term, 15, 20 years, then it might be too late.
Do you, on the other hand, think, as a couple of people on your page on Facebook were talking about, that we should be talking about building our own Galt's Gulch, or as one person, DJ Jinx, I think is his name. He says, why don't we build a rocket ship to another planet and just let all the people who have messed it up fry here, basically?
You know, I'm getting too old. You know, I don't know if I'd survive the G-forces that are necessary to escape the atmosphere. I mean, all the power to you. If you can build a rocket and go to some other planet and build a new civilization, you know, that's a fantastic dream to have. Just be realistic about the chances of it happening. What you first need to do is make the billions necessary to do it. You know, team up with, what's the guy's name, the founder of PayPal, who's building a rocket, building rockets, the SpaceX or whatever it is. Anyway, he's got kind of an Israeli name. But the point is, yeah, I mean, if there were opportunities to really build the Gold Gulch, then it would be a real option, but there aren't. Look, the Americans and the Russians and everybody else, they have these satellites. They can see what I'm drinking in my cup if I'm standing outside. What are you going to hide from them? You can't hide anywhere. You know, people are talking about floating cities in the ocean. I mean, how long do you think they're going to let you survive out there if you're truly free? Let's say you open a free bank in one of these, in this newly created free country in Gold Gulch. And the bank has true privacy rules, so you're not going to disclose to IRS and to the feds and to the Homeland Security and all the myriad government agencies that are trying to destroy our lives. You know, what if you don't disclose? How long do you think before U.S. Battleships off your coast? So there's one way it works. I figured this out, right?
Okay.
There's one way if you want to start your own country in the middle of the ocean in an artificial island. There's only one way it'll work. And that is if you can get your hands on a few nukes. And then you point them at Washington and you say, you know, mutually assured destruction type of deal.
Right.
Leave us alone. But, you know, you're not going to get the nukes. So let's forget about it. Let's focus on what's doable, what better be doable, which is to change the world. You know, the other thing is, man, I mean, in spite of the fact of how lousy things are and how crappy things are in this country, it's still better to live in a civilization than in the middle of the ocean or in the middle of the jungle. You know, the fact that I can drive up and see opera in Los Angeles, the fact that I can go to some of the best restaurants in the world in this area, the fact that I can fly to New York and spend a week in one of the greatest cities ever, or to London, or to go to Swiss Alps or whatever, right? Civilization is incredibly valuable. You know, let's fight for it. Don't give it up. Oh, by the way, it's Elon Musk.
Yeah, someone in the chat room, Henry, there. Gave
thanks,
us
Henry.
The name. Thank you. Yeah, so it's too soon to give up. So in terms of strategies for fighting for it here, Catherine on your page asks about the Tea Party. Is the Tea Party going to be sunk by the social issues faction, she asks. And I guess there's two different senses in which you could talk about the social issues faction killing the Tea Party. One would be it's not going to be relevant on the national stage, which I actually don't see, because I would see that the social issues faction would make it more popular today, to have that part of the Tea Party, because then it's just not, they're not all about free markets in a secular sense. They have the social issues too, so it makes them attractive to Republicans. But I think she means it, does it kill it in the sense of being effective, building us towards the right type of society and government?
Yeah, so look, the two elements that are trying to take over the Tea Parties and have been from the beginning, one is kind of mainstream Republicans. You know, the Republican Party is trying to capture them. And I think that, that would be a disaster, obviously. And they're trying, and I don't think they've been very successful. I think that the Tea Party has been fairly successful at staying kind of outside of the mainstream and not being co-opted by people like Romney or people like, people just the kind of the mainstream Republican Party and the Republican leadership. The second part is the religious right. The religious right is clearly trying to take over the Tea Party. And let's not talk about social issues. This is about religion. This is about the role of religion in politics. Social issues sounds so nice. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm all for social issues. I'm a strong believer in social issues. This is about religion. And we want to keep religion separate from government. And I if we can all agree to separation of church and state, that would be a huge step forward. I could work with people who agree on a separation of church and state, even if they don't agree with me on some other specific issues. So they are really trying to take over. And of course, for them, it's going to be relatively easy because they at least pretend to accept kind of the economic issues. But of course, it's just pretend because look at Rick Santorum. Rick Santorum is clearly a big government conservative. Mm-hmm. He's clearly a populist when it comes to capitalism. He's clearly the kind of guy who wants to manipulate markets. He's a mixed economy guy. He wants to manipulate markets to achieve his ends, which in this case are pro-manufacturing or
exactly,
whatever,
yeah.
whatever the thing of the day is. So the religious right is not pro-free markets, but they pretend to be. And so they have a really good shot. And mix that up with the fact that the Tea Party people are religious. There's no question they're religious. They're dominantly religious. Even the Atlas Shrugged fans among the Tea Partiers are religious. So if they have a real in. So far, I think certain elements within the Tea Party have resisted making this about religion. And that is a really, really good thing. And as a consequence, I still think the Tea Party is a place where we can talk to. But look, this is an issue of resources. So the religious right has hundreds of millions of dollars at its disposal. Churches, they have these phenomenal speakers, very charismatic. They have access to millions of people, and they are going to get in front of the Tea Party, and they're going to pound them, and they're going to keep after them, and they keep going for them. They also have candidates. They have Santorum. I mean, Newt Gingrich is a religious right type. He's turned into one.
Yeah.
Well, but
yeah.
He has. He's converted to Catholicism. You really not believe. You know, it's interesting how the religious right intellectuals and politicians are Catholics. There's a reason for that. But you've got these. They have incredible amounts of resources, and we have nothing. Nothing. We're a speck. We're insignificant. What we have, which makes us powerful, is Ayn Rand, and we have Atlas Shrugged, which has had an impact on the Tea Parties, whether they like it or not, or whether the religious right likes it or not. What we need is your help. Get involved. Get in there with the secular message. Talk to them. Don't let them be co-opted by the religious right. Get my book in front of them. Get John Allison's book in front of them. Bring speakers in who are secular and really capitalist. And, we together need to start working on affecting change in the culture. You know, we need to devote real resources to that. I'd say, get off Facebook and get off Twitter and get off, trying to check off your objectivist credentials. And, get to work about trying to save your own life because it's your life. Nobody can save it for you. We're all going to have to work really, really hard to make a dent in this culture. It's an uphill battle no matter how many resources you throw at it, and we're way under-resourced. Get your act together and start working towards really trying to change the culture and understand that it's going to take a real philosophical argument. It's going to take, it's going to take people who really understand objectivism. It's going to take people who are committed to rational egoism and to a proper epistemology. But the focus should be out there on advocating for these ideas, on getting to the culture, on arguing with our enemies, on aligning ourselves with our allies, making our allies that much better, and really working to get Ayn Rand's ideas become part of the culture. That's when we win. And in that process, you are going to encounter lots of people who are going to agree with a little bit and not everything. You're going to bump into Christian objectivists and Buddhist objectivists and all kinds of types of objectivists. So, and you need to call them on it and move on. You call them on it. You say, it's inconsistent to be Christian and objectivist. I guess for you personally, it's better that you're a Christian objectivist and a Christian. But in the end of the day, those are incompatible and you're living a contradiction. And then there's more to do. There are more people to talk to. There's more to be engaged with. And let me just add one thing. So we're talking a little bit about activism. The most important thing you can do in terms of activism is make your life the best life that it can be. Make your life the life that your neighbors and your coworkers and the people you interact with on a day-to-day want to emulate. So they come to you and say, how come you're so happy? How come you're so successful? What are you doing right? You know, so, and that requires you to study objectivism. So buy Leonard's book. For that, you need Leonard's book. Mm-hmm. Buy Leonard's book. Buy, you know, one of the really treasures in objectivism that everybody should listen to again, and now you can read, is Understanding Objectivism. Go buy Understanding Objectivism. Now, Understanding Objectivism on some issues might not be the latest word, so go and get Objectivism Through Induction, which is another brilliant Leonard. So you can combine Understanding Objectivism and Objectivism Through Induction as a self-study program to make yourself better as an objectivist. You know, so make yourself better as an objectivist, item one. Item two, go out there and convince as many people as you can to read Ayn Rand and to take your ideas seriously. If we can do that, if all the thousands on Facebook listening to the show, doing all this stuff, just dedicated themselves to those two things, then we have a shot. If you don't dedicate your things to those two things, we don't have a shot. And it doesn't matter how many talks I give and how many times I appear on television. It just ain't happening, people. So we need your help. You need to get engaged. You need to be involved. You need to become much more active than what I'm being objectivist today.
Are you yourself optimistic about convincing those on the religious right that they should abandon God? I mean, because the types of things that I'm thinking about for people who are older, people who probably won't change their mind about their religion, I think about strategies for convincing them that they should agree that separation of church and state is the best option. So I think about things like, well, you know, don't you want separation of church and state? Because what if the religion that's going to be mixed with our politics is going to be Islam, for instance? And surely Christian Tea Partiers don't want Islam to be the one. So why don't we just all agree that separation of church and state, because there's so many different faiths, and what makes any faith better than anybody else? You believe in your God. This person believes in his God.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Although I mean, I think we have to be careful on the particular example you give, because I think we come across a little I don't think Islam is a threat to the separation of church and state in America. Christianity is clearly. And, you know, so and the Christians will rise up and kill all the Muslims before Islam becomes a real threat in this country. So I don't think that is the issue. I think the issue has to be separation of church and state, because do you want the government to be dictating your personal preferences one way or the other? And, you know, the Catholics and the Mormons and the evangelicals don't trust each other. So you can use other Christian sects. You don't even have to go outside of Christianity to make this point. But yes, so I don't think you start off with a Christian or trying to convince them not to believe in God. That is not the main issue, right? It is ultimately, but it's not the issue you're going to have any kind of success with.
Right.
It's not where you start. You need to start with what you view as a overlap with us, right? Where do we share some common ground, or at least superficially, because we know if deeply we don't. But superficially, where do we share common ground? We show common ground with some of them on the ideas of capitalism, on the ideas of freedom. Start there. Then drill a little deeper and go to self-interest. Because, you know, and link it. This is what I do, and I do it all the time, and I think with some success. We got to link it to the founding fathers, right? Right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Whose pursuit of happiness? Your happiness. Each one of our happiness. So this country was founded on the principle of self-interest, whether the founders were explicit about it or not. It's in the Declaration. Individual rights. Whose rights? An individual's rights. So the country was founded on the principle of individualism. If we could get a significant number of American Christians to accept individualism, and then they live the contradiction, right? And we know contradictions can't last, and we know the more consistent will win out. So you can't end it there. It can't be the end of the argument. But if we can get over the next 20 years, because this is a multi-generational battle, but if we can get in the next generation significant number of Christians to recognize that this country is based on individualism and have some notion of what individualism means and even have some respect for reason, granted, they won't have a complete respect for reason because they'll still be religious, they'll still believe in God, then, you know, then we've made a lot of progress. That's one generation. Then the next generation, work on reason and God. So in two generations, we win. But it's probably going to take three or four generations to completely win, the whole world become you know, atheist and objectivist. But you can't go for it all. It's not all or nothing. You got to go in steps, because if we say, you know, I think Leonard in his book gives Western civilization something like 40 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
But his idea is not we either in 40 years are objectivist society or we're dictatorship, right? His idea is whether dictatorship or objectivism has had enough influence on the culture that we're not a dictatorship. We're still free to some extent.
Right.
So this is, I hate to use the word incrementalism, but the political cultural progress we are going to make is going to be incremental. We got to get things to become a little bit better. And if we can, if we set a goal in the next generation to increase people's respect for capitalism and individualism, right? Now, we have to argue that it's all based on reason and A is A and metaphysics. We have to make those arguments. But accept that the culture won't accept them yet. That if we can just the culture to accept some semblance of individualism, that generation, it's going to be much easier for on the second generation to work on the rest of the stuff, on the rest of the philosophy. So let's keep working. Let's keep pushing. Let's take it one step at a time and work forward. And somebody just posted a Chicago Tea Party. You know, invite me to come and speak. I'm in North Carolina frequently. I'd love to come speak to the Charlotte Tea Party, Andy. And if you can get, 20% of the members to come and hear me speak, I'll be in, I think you're in Charlotte, right? Charlotte Tea Party. I'll be in Charlotte and speak in the fall. And we'll sell the books and I'll do a book signing.
Sounds excellent. So in terms of the audience and the ones that you're going to convince about individualism, you seem to be talking about the Christian right as an audience for this. You think that they are going to be more receptive at this point in time than the secular left. Is that true?
I do. I think the secular left is too dominated by nihilism to be open to what we have to say. Now, I'm not ruling them out, and certainly we should form coalitions with the secular left when there are opportunities to form coalitions with them, whether it's about separation of church and state, whether it's about stem cells or abortion or a variety of different issues. We should definitely find ways to work with them. I just think that they are much more likely to reject us out of hand and to not want to work with us than people on the right tend to be. And again, I'm not talking about forming coalitions with the religious right. I don't want to do that. The religious right entities, we should have nothing to do with them. We should find those elements like the Tea Party, which have not accepted religion as a part of government explicitly, and who are at least stating that they want to focus on
reducing the size and scope of government
on these political issues. And as long as political/economic issues, as long as they commit to that, then we should work with them and give them the kind of intellectual ammunition to resist the religious right. So I'm not arguing that we should advocate to the religious right. I'm just acknowledging the fact that most people in the Tea Party movement are religious. That's a fact.
Right, right. There are a couple of questions that I got here about education, and that one of the things that we might be able to convince the GOP, Tea Party of, et cetera, is that we need to get the government out of education. And I think that that would serve probably both their ends and our ends, certainly. You can see the kind of mess that happens when we have government schools, public schools, you know, both because of the leftist agenda that's being taught in the schools, and everybody on the right complains about that all the time. But then there's something like this. Governor Walker, Scott Walker, who people like, a very popular right-wing candidate, just signed a bill about teaching abstinence in public schools, saying that they are supposed to stress abstinence is the only reliable way to prevent pregnancy. And also sex education teachers, which already are established and exist in public schools, they shouldn't be teaching this stuff, but hey, they're talking about it. It gives those teachers the option to ignore contraception completely. So this is the kind of tinkering, social engineering that's going on in this context. And would it be possible to make common ground with people on the right and say, let's get government out of schools as one part of a long-term strategy?
Yes, and this issue of sex education is a good example of that. you know, some parents don't want sex education in schools. Some parents do want sex education in schools. If the schools were completely private, you would send your kids to school that followed your preferences, and you wouldn't send them to another, and you wouldn't be funding a school that didn't follow your preferences. So if somebody is deeply religious and they don't want their kids exposed to sex education, then they don't have to fund a school that does. I think that's completely within their right not to fund a school. Or, for example, evolution, even evolution, right? If they don't believe in evolution, why should they fund a school that teaches evolution, right? So the solution to these issues, and that's true on the left as well, if parents on the left believe in global warming and school is teaching anti-global warming stuff, you know, in Texas or something, they shouldn't have to fund it. So each parent gets to choose which school, you know, and the leftists can start their schools and the religionists can start their schools and the objectivists can start schools, and let's compete in a marketplace of education. So absolutely, I think one of the most important issues, maybe the most important issue that we can really trump and really push, is privatizing schools. And I've given up on the whole idea of vouchers, charter schools, tax credits, all of that. I think we need to be very blatant about this. I think we need to be upfront about it. And my experience is that audience are receptive to a message that says, privatize the schools, sell them all, get government out of education completely. Local government, state government, federal government, all of them need to be out of education. Let's have completely private education. And you can make the case in terms of competition, in terms of innovation, in terms of individual rights. Mm-hmm. You have a right to send your kids to whatever school you want to and not forced to finance somebody else's school. You can make this argument on so many different fronts. Why if you're not willing to use the post office to mail a letter, you're willing to send your kids to a government entity like the post office? You know, there's a government school just like the post office is a government post. So we need to make a strong argument against government education and for private education, real private education. And we really need this to be a campaign over the next 15, 20 years, because if we don't win that one, it's going to be hard to do the education, right? It's going to be hard to get people who are smart enough, who are, you know how to read and know how to write and are capable of understanding objectivist ideas at the rate in which public education is deteriorating. So this is probably the biggest issue we have. And let me just, somebody on the thing, you know, was saying the only way we can defend individual rights is through reason. Absolutely. We have to defend it through reason. We need a push to defend it through reason. But we need to take a primarily positive stand. We need to be pro-individualism, pro-individual rights, pro-reason. And we need to show how reason links to individual rights. And we need to push that and push that and push that. You know, and by implication, you know, be attacking religion. But if you start a conversation with somebody religious by attacking religion, you're not going to get anywhere. So you, as soon as you do that, you've given up. You've given up on, you know, on trying to convince them.
Okay. So education and
won't we have to fight state governments to accomplish this educational reform? Absolutely. You have to fight all governments. It's not a federal issue. It's a state issue. It's a local issue. It's very much, and you could do this state by state. I mean, imagine, I think that it's possible for the state of Texas to privatize all its schools and not for the state of California. I mean, that would be an interesting kind of experiment. So, you know, let's gang up on a state and try to do this. But, you know, let's start talking about this. This should be one of our biggest issues. It's privatizing education completely.
Some of the candidates have talked about eliminating the Department of Education. I believe Perry was one of them. Of course, he forgot which departments he wanted to get rid of. But I think also Ron Paul had talked about entirely eliminating the Department of Education.
Yeah, but
you
so
don't
did,
think that getting the top...
So did Ronald Reagan, right?
Okay.
Ronald Reagan came into office promising to eliminate the Department of Education. It was bigger when he left than when he started. And Secretary of Education for many years was Bill Bennett, who used it to cultivate conservative values in schools, inculcate the schools. No, I mean, these conservatives, I wish I could believe them. I wish you could. It would be great if these guys really believed in eliminating the Department of Education. But that's one little teeny, itsy, bitsy, example of what could be done. But the fact is, as I think Daniel pointed out on the blog, the fact is that almost all of education is done on a state level. So, getting rid of the federal Department of Education does very little to truly privatize education. This is a battle that has to be fought at the state level. This is a battle that has to be fought against the teachers' unions and the political establishment, but more importantly, with your neighbors, because all your neighbors, every single one of them believes in public education. This is a long-term campaign, again, a generational campaign, to change people's minds and to convince them that bringing the innovation that brought us the iPad and the iPhone and computers and Wi-Fi and all this great technology, bringing that innovation, not the technology, the innovation, the spirit, the competition, the excitement to the field of education is incredibly important and incredibly exciting and incredibly valuable. And if we can convince them of that, then then we have, again, a chance of winning. If we could just win this little battle, then we will probably win the war. So if you're going to fight for a cause, this is a big, big one.
But, of course, privatizing the schools, people are going to be up in arms and say, but education is a right. It has to be provided for free. And so we're going to have subsidies. So it goes back to the moral battle. It goes back to altruism and selfishness.
Yeah, you can do this without fighting for individual rights and without fighting for self-interest and making all those arguments. But you can also make the argument right now. You can make the argument, the practical argument as well, because public education is scorned by most people and it's viewed as pretty bad. So we can combine those two arguments together and make them both. And again, don't fight for charter schools. Don't fight for vouchers. You know, it's privatizing the school. It's all of it. We want the whole shebang. Charter schools, our goal is not to save public education, which is what charter schools would be. Our goal is to destroy public education.
Or as people like to call it, government schools.
Yes.
Yes. In terms of free speech, which is hugely important, and I think it's now been linked to issues of privacy because people are getting concerned that their ability to associate and communicate ideas online is being compromised because of government monitoring of the various forums and things like this. I want to ask you this, and of course, because privacy is a big issue to me, and I have sitting here, let's get your shoot from the hip reaction to this. There has been a report from Wired Online, Wired Magazine, that the government is building right now something called the Utah Data Center.
Mm-hmm.
Huge, massive supercomputers. They have had to coin a new term called yottabytes to describe the amount of information that this thing can process. And what they're envisioning is that every email sent by anybody anywhere in the United States could conceivably be filtered through this huge data center and analyzed through for various content and things like this, and then the government can find you if you're communicating about things that are anti-government or whatever it is. You know, they have to use an algorithm and decide what they're searching for, but you don't have any privacy anymore, and that it's going to affect your ability to communicate with other people and your free speech, and we're all going to, you know, shut up by Big Brother, basically. What are your thoughts on things like this?
You know, my view is all this stuff is way over the top, exaggerated. The Gestapo and the KGB existed without any technology. When the time comes, when they want to hang me, they'll know where to find me. It's not through monitoring my email. That's just one more tool that the statists have. Fine. Given what people post on Facebook these days, it is absolutely scary to me what they might be writing privately in email. So I pity the government censors who have to read all that crap.
But see, they don't have to read it, right?
Yeah,
they just
know,
have a computer algorithm,
look,
scan it, and
I mean, it's horrible, it's statist, but is this the biggest problem we have? No, not at all. The problem is statism and altruism and anti-reason. The problem is that, you know, that that government is growing and is taxing us and regulating us to hell. I want to get by this stupid security, the TSA stuff at the airports.
Right.
It really pisses me off. I hate it. I hate the TSA with, you know, the little Gestapos. I mean, they're inefficient. I mean, The horrible, the whole mechanism is just disgusting. Anyway, so I found that there's a way to do this, both for international travel and domestic travel. I went to the government. I gave them my fingerprints. I let them scan my retina. I gave them access to everything they want, right? They can look at it. I don't do anything illegal. You know, they know who I am. I run the Ayn Rand Institute, after all. If they really decide to clamp down on pro-capitalist and pro-individualist, they don't have to read my email to discover me.
Right.
They know who I am. I gave them all this information, and now I get to zip through security in some airports really, really easily, pre-9/11 kind of fashion, which is really cool. My last worry that I have is that the government is reading my email. I mean, I don't say anything in my email that I don't say in public. Do you? I mean, when, why? You know, we should be fighting for this. Don't hide your views. So that's not to say that I don't think privacy is important, that I don't think people have a right to, you know, to have their communication stay private. But that is not, in my view, that is not the biggest problem that we face today. And, you know, and people have made this example, I think they raised this about the mosque issue, and then they raised it about SOPA. Oh, my God, the government now, this gives the government the power to shut you down and to come into your house and to take everything you own. It already has it. We don't have a constitution in this country. The government writes whatever laws it was. You know, there were all these executive orders that the president signs that gives them special powers and stuff. We already live in a country where if the government wanted to, and it wanted to come after you or me or Amy, they could and they would, and we could fight it, but it would be very, very difficult to fight it. So we are beyond the point of defending ourselves from, you know, just think of RICO. And you know, this isn't even new. RICO Act is this act that was passed in the 70s. To catch gangsters, but it's now used on businessmen, where they confiscate your assets first, and then you have to prove that you're innocent. And it's on and on and on. You know,
what about this poor guy that you posted about? He was thrown in jail because he had a siding code violation on his house. They just came and arrested him and took him away.
So we already live in a world in which the government has this humongous power over our lives, and it can use this power in incredibly abusive ways. So if that power is increased a little bit or decreased a little bit, it ain't going to change the world. What's going to change the world is a fundamental new understanding of what government is about and what life is about and what your life is about. It's a fundamental understanding of the role of government and your relationship with that government and what your responsibility is and who your responsibility is to yourself. Those are the kind of things we need to be fighting over. And yeah, we can use these examples of government abuse. We can use the examples of horrible laws to point out these fundamental issues. But don't get caught up in libertarian-like conspiracy theories or libertarian freaking out that the world is coming to an end tomorrow and the government's going to shut us all down tomorrow. This is a slow process. It's going to take a long time. Our freedoms are eroding at a steady but slow process. It's getting worse and worse and worse and worse. It's not any one thing. It's not going to be SOPA. It's not going to be this particular law or that particular law. It's the cumulative impact of all these things. And the only way to fight it is to fight the philosophy behind it and to present an alternative.
So you don't think doom is around the corner? What about the prognosticators? For instance, I've heard Mark Stein, who will put out some statistics and tell you that in just a few years, we are going to be financing the entire Chinese military with the interest that we pay on the debt that we owe to them and things like this.
So I don't think the risk to the United States is China or Islam or terrorists or Iran or anybody.
What about the dollar crashing and we're
going
to
become real risk.
Okay.
So the real risk, well, dollar will crash and we can have high inflation. But we can fix it. They're quick and easy fixes to these things. They'll be painful. I said easy. Easy kind of to do, but painful to live through. But we are not about to disappear. You know, go out there. Go out into the world a little bit, some of you guys. Americans produce. Technology is advancing. The economy is barely moving, but it's moving. We've just gone through this enormous economic collapse, and yet we're still here. There's going to be another economic collapse. It's going to be worse than the one we just experienced. Life is going to be more difficult. But I think it's likely we'll survive it. There's an amazing flexibility in this economy. There's an amazing amount of wealth in this economy. And if you're talented and if you're productive and if you're smart, you'll do okay, right? You'll do okay. We're not going to do great. So the problem is us. The problem is our economic, you know, prospects into the future. It gets worse and worse the more you project out into the future. But that also means there's more and more time to change things. And the funny thing is, and you might call it an unfortunate thing, but is that small changes can make big differences. So if somehow a miracle happens and a real Republican gets elected and the House and Senate don't focus on social issues and don't ramp up government because they want to out-liberal the liberals, but actually do a few simple things like deregulate just a little bit, lower taxes, cut government spending, not in dramatic fashion like I would, but somewhat, you could get this economy booming. I mean, it wouldn't take that much. Just cut regulations dramatically, you know, really cut regulations. You could do a few things, do away with Obamacare, do away with Dodd-Frank, do away with a few other things. And this economy could really speed up. Now, if the economy grows at 5% a year and you cut, which is a lot, you know, which is going to take a lot to do, and you cut government spending a little bit, then a lot of these physical problems somewhat go away. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen. There's a lot of doom and gloom out there. It's mostly economic. And all the other threats, you know, China's not going to war. China's too busy internally to go to war. And, you know, the threats in the Middle East, if we were serious about them, we could annihilate them in hours or weeks or days. So they're not the threat. The threat is us. The threat is, you know, do we want to live in a free country? Are we willing to defend this free country? Are we willing to do what's necessary to continue this country's existence?
And in terms of helping to educate people about living in a free country and the philosophy that they need in order to do that, there's a couple things I also wanted to help you plug. I saw them on your page. These fundraising dinners that you're scheduling through the Institute. This is Atlas Shrugged Revolution. It's an event you've been doing for a few years now, right?
Yeah, we've done three in New York so far. The first year we raised about $400,000. The second year we raised just over $500,000. And last year at one of the dinners we raised $1 million. So for those of you out there, and I've seen it on Facebook, for those of you complaining about $25,000 tables, obviously it's not for you, right? Obviously these dinners are targeted at people who can afford $25,000 tables. If you can afford $1,500, you can come as an individual, and I encourage you to do so. There is one in Chicago on May 3rd. It's going to have Stephen Moore from the Wall Street Journal be a speaker. So will John Allison, and I will be speaking as well. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be very exciting, and I hope we raise, you know, $300,000 to $500,000 at that event. And I encourage you, if you're in Chicago, you're near Chicago, and you can afford $1,500, it's a great way to spend an evening and to really support the efforts of the Institute. And then on September 20th, we will have the next one in New York. I hope we can raise another $1 million, but we're going to sure try to do that. And come out and support the Institute and enjoy a fun event and meet a lot of us who are, you know, who work at the Institute. You're going to meet a lot of us there.
If you want to learn more about these events, go to arievents.com. It's arievents.com. And again, for those people who missed at the beginning, we were also talking about Yaron's book at the beginning.
Yeah, and let me just also plug Facebook. Like me on Facebook. Mm-hmm. Get your friends to like me on Facebook. You know, it's pretty pathetic that I've got less than 5,000 likes. I've got to believe that more than 5,000 people like me out there. So it's pretty depressing. It's only 5,000. All these other intellectuals have so many more. So it's a sign that we're really making progress in the culture when I have six-figure likes. You can follow me on Twitter, Whitebrook. Of course, the blog, capitalism.ayinrand.org. I think you'll really enjoy that. And the book comes out in September. Pre-order it. Tell your friends about it. It will, by the way, be available on Kindle. So if you wait a little bit, it'll appear on Amazon as a Kindle edition. You'll be able to pre-order that in a few weeks or months. We'll see, but it'll definitely be out on Kindle.
Great. Thank you, Yaron, for being with us. This is Don't Let It Go Unheard. Please join me again next week when we'll return to the normal format of Bosch and I talking about the events of the day. And if you like this podcast, go on Don't Let It Go Unheard, the page on Facebook. You can like us there. And you can follow me on Twitter as well. It's Amy Peekoff. So thanks, everyone. Have a good evening, and we will talk to you next week. Happy Easter.